But first, as part of our India Now series, we look at Indian media.
I think the figures are not quite what they seem, in the sense that there are other factors as well that come into this vibrant picture. But yes, in terms of newspapers, for instance, because we have a new generation of neoliterate people who are interested in engaging with print, our newspapers are continuing to rise in terms of circulation, which comes as a surprise to other parts of the world, which have seen a decline in print.
Well, we've seen a disappearance of print. Paper after paper in the West, as you know, is stopping the presses, and if it lingers on, it's in a downloaded form. But of course, India's media is so diverse. The papers and the TV and radio have to come in a variety of dialects and languages. Do they also come with an appropriate plethora of political perspectives?
No, I think that's perhaps where it's not as vibrant as one would hope it would be. Partly because of late, for instance, a more sort of power-driven discourse has pervaded the media. And when I say power-driven, I say that these are, news that is influenced by power brokers, both political and corporate, as well as advertisers and the entire army of, influencers of media content.
In this country, media control is in the hands of a couple of major players. That's echoed to some extent in the US. Please tell me that that India is neither a monopoly or an oligopoly.
No, I am afraid I can't tell you that, because there are thriving monopolies and they are growing by the day, and in fact making inroads both vertically and horizontally, in the sense that they are pervading other media as well. And it's not just the print, but it's also television. In an earlier era, cross-media ownership was frowned upon, but presently we see a flourishing of that. And we see some of our most major players speaking across media platforms.
Let's bring Sarith in here. Sarith, you and I would have both been watching with some fascination what's been happening in Italy, where, of course, Berlusconi is so dominant as a media controller and manipulator. Here, of course, the figure would be Rupert Murdoch. Are there figures as famous as that in India?
Well, there are. One of the things that Pamela mentioned was this idea of cross-media ownership. And if you look across India, especially in the regional media, you'd see a number of significant political parties, number of significant politicians who have vast interests in the media, and particularly in television media. In the state that I come from, for example, in Tamil Nadu, both the major political parties have some significant stake or the other in one or the other of the big television news channels. And this is a serious problem which the Indian laws haven't been able to address, because the idea is that media ownership should look to promote a free press and not curtail it. But the regulators simply haven't been able to step in here and prevent these oligarchies, because every time they try and take some step towards preventing this oligarchy, the owners go to court and claim that their rights to free speech are being impinged on.
Sarith, in your HuffPo piece, you say a third of the news channels are owned by politicians or political affiliates, and that owning a news channel has become a practical necessity for a political party in India. That's a leap which nowhere hasn't been taken anywhere else in the democratic world.
Yeah, I speak for instance from my own, if I were to bring the example of my own state once again, you simply cannot do politics here without having some stake in the media, or at least having someone close to you who has one who has an important stake in media. And this is the same for all the other neighboring states as well, whether it's Karnataka or Andhra Pradesh. All of these big political parties here enjoy some stake or the other in a big news channel. And if they don't have that, that means that they can't get their message across, their propaganda across. And that would ultimately lead to electoral defeat.
Sarith, do the news channels owned by political parties pretend to be fair and balanced, or are they, you know, manifestly, unashamedly propaganda outlets?
I think they're often manifestly, unashamedly propaganda outlets, and I don't think they're particularly worried about these perceptions. They're quite happy to project their own views, to put their own opinions across, without sort of having this larger belief that they ought to be shown, or at least ought to show themselves to be independent. That's simply lacking.
Back to you, Pamela. Tell me about, you're talking in Australia, as you know, on the ABC, which is the national network, the national broadcaster. Surely there is a parallel organization in India which has some degree of autonomy.
We have Doordarshan, and our radio equivalent is All India Radio. And both are actually under the control of the government. Although there were attempts maybe a couple of decades ago to set up an autonomous broadcasting authority called the Prasar Bharati. And Prasar Bharati still exists. But actually, it's just a fig leaf, really, because in terms of control, the state media is completely under the thrall of the government of the day. It has been so in the past, and it continues to be so in the in the present as well, and possibly in the future.
So back to you, Sarith. So Congress will know better than the BJP.
No, I don't think so. Of course, it's a matter of degree and it's a matter of proportions. But I don't think that you can particularly claim or make an argument for the previous government being especially strong on media rights. They did a number of things which sort of impinged press sense. I mean, which impinged press freedom, which I think violated rights to freedom of speech in very many different ways. And not just the freedom of the press, but freedom of independent-minded people in general. And this is a problem with governments across India, and it might be a matter of degree and proportion, of course, but I don't think you can claim that any government in India has been particularly in favor of an independent press.
The most pernicious form of censorship, and I've seen it even operate here at the ABC during particularly troubled times, is self-censorship. And it's so dangerous because, of course, it's invisible. It's not clear to the listener, to the reader, that it's taking place. But one feels that it's a big problem in India. We, for example, did a program on caste, talking about the problem, particularly the Untouchables, the Dalits. And I get the feeling that caste problems are sort of, in a sense, airbrushed out of public debates.
Well, all of this flows from the general architecture of the laws that are present in India, right from the constitution downwards. And this architecture, I think, sort of tends to have a chilling effect on the media and tends to have a chilling effect on free speech. And I suppose with issues of caste, the problem becomes that this element of self-censorship kind of gets written into the media's psyche almost, because they simply find that some of these laws are not in favor of free speech, do not promote the ideals of free speech. And I think the other big problem is with these colonial laws which continue to exist, such as a law which continues to criminalize defamation. And, if you make a statement against a person in power, you're potentially facing criminal sanctions. So you've always got to be, as a media outlet, as a journalist, got to be careful about what you write, because you're writing under this threat of criminal sanctions. And that tends to have a chilling effect on speech.
Pamela, that chilling effect was seen in, big stories like the death of a Chief Justice, hate crimes by BJP supporters, corporate crime, being reported reluctantly or not at all.
Yes, and you're quite right that self-censorship is the most pernicious form of censorship because it's invisible. And the problem really is that people don't even know how much they have changed. The ability to speak has been actually undermined in so many ways. And the old timers actually see the change coming in when, you know, in the old days you got a job in a media house and you remain there with fair amount of security, but now you're on contract. And the contract system actually hollowed out independent journalism in many ways, because it then meant that you could be, you know, hauled up at any point and your contract withdrawn. And so, I mean, these are incremental changes that have happened over a period of time.
Such changes, of course, are happening everywhere. We've talked about this phenomenon in Spain. We've seen it, well, we've seen it in the US. And I think there are also cases where it's taking place here. That raises another issue. And Pamela, a comment on fake news. I understand that's alive and well, that there are multiple instances where Modi and others have shamelessly planted self-serving news in friendlier papers and television.
Yes, in fact, fake news actually arises from the old propaganda model, you know, and one doesn't see these connections, but actually those are the links. And yes, we saw a lot of that happening in the 2014 general election, where the attempt to prime, you know, attitudes was there in full flow through the use of media as well. So, we are seeing that happening, and we know that in the 2014 election, for instance, there were almost evangelists whose specific job was to really influence public opinion. And to some extent, that same army of people continue, you know, using social media and other media to, you know, sort of promote their point of view. So I think we just as self-censorship is invisible, trolling is invisible too, because it happens in a sort of under the cover of another identity very often.
Before we go back to Sarith, Pamela, would you tell the listener the story of Bobby Ghosh?
Now, we don't have the full facts of that story because Mr. Bobby Ghosh himself has not come on record as to what really happened. So much of this is surmise, but it is true that he had introduced a vibrant section in his newspaper that tracked hate crime. And it was a popular element. And it was said that the owner of his publication, who wanted to invite the Prime Minister for a very important function in which her media house was involved, you know, agreed to let him go.
We're talking, let's identify the paper, the Hindustan Times.
That's right.
Immensely That's influential right. journal, isn't it?
That's right.
So they let him go, yeah?
Yeah. But like I said, we have no proof of it because Mr. Ghosh himself has not uttered a word of this in public.
So I like the idea of his hate tracker. Pamela, sometimes the ante is well and truly upped and it leads to violence against journalists and to murders. Let's take one case. Last September in Bangalore, Gauri Lankesh was murdered in a gangland-style killing. And this was not an isolated instance.
Actually, Gauri Lankesh's murder was linked to the earlier murders of three very respected rationalists in Maharashtra and Karnataka. And so in a sense, she was seen as part of that same, you know, the attack that was launched on rationalists in this country. And Gauri was one of the free spirits who really spoke out on a range of issues, including she took on her own government at the state level, at the center, And she also passionately espoused various causes, and she paid for it with her life, especially since she also took on Hindu fundamentalists in many ways, came out, you know, without self-censorship. And that's the point.
So, Ruth, how common is it for the defamation cases to be successful? Let's talk about defamation for a while.
Defamation is a weapon in India, and there are two kinds of defamation. There's civil defamation and there's criminal defamation. And I don't think much of this really depends on the ultimate success of the case, because the devil lies in the process. And if we look at civil defamation suits, they're often kind of lodged in regions that are very far from where the media house might be located. And if we saw in Caravan's own case, and Caravan magazine published this profile by Siddhartha Deb on Arindam Chaudhary, who was a dean of this university, of this so-called university, an Indian Institute of Planning and Management. And the legal suit was filed in the state of Assam, and in fact in a city or in a town which was 300 kilometers from Assam's capital. And ultimately Caravan had to move the Supreme Court of India and have this case transferred to Delhi. And just the other day, the injunction was finally vacated, and the story has gone back online now. And there are numerous other instances of civil defamation. We have cases against the erstwhile aviation minister, which have been filed by the erstwhile aviation minister, sort of injuncting a book that shows him in poor light. We've had books being pulped by publishers because publishers sort of face this threat of civil defamation, where huge amounts of money are claimed as damages and injunctions are granted by courts.
But as you say, the outcome isn't so important. It's like a stop writ, isn't it? So this is where Adani uses the tool.
Right. Yeah. You move the courts. You try and get an injunction on the publication, and then you've got to go through the whole process of a civil trial, which might take years on end before you can finally come out of it. And so the real devil, I think, here is in the process. And criminal defamation is even worse. Criminal defamation flows from India's Indian Penal Code, which was drafted by Lord Macaulay, and this is sort of a colonial Victorian era legacy. And this is a particularly pernicious law, because it effectively can send you to jail for something that you write or something that you speak. And the Indian Supreme Court has upheld the constitutional validity of this law, and it's found that there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, that this is a weapon that is open to people who claim that they've been defamed. And many people have had to face the wrath of this law. You've had the Greenpeace activist Priya Pillai, who has a criminal defamation case pending against her, and the court has said that that case can go to trial. So, which means that she'll effectively have to face the process of criminal trial for several years before she can really come out of it. Now, ultimately, she might get acquitted and she might not, you know, face a conviction. But just the process, just this threat of having to potentially go to jail, I think is worrisome enough.
Sarith, tell me about SLAP, Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation.
Right, so these SLAP suits, which I think the name is sort of derived from American jurisprudence, and it takes various different forms. And in the case of a civil suit for defamation, as I mentioned, the idea is to kind of slap a suit in the most inconvenient place possible, and which is what happened in the case of the Caravan magazine article, where the person who claimed that he was defamed, he filed a suit in the state of Assam when Caravan is being published out of Delhi. And the logic was that the magazine does sell in Assam, and that's good enough to give the courts in Assam some sort of jurisdictional authority over this case. And this kind of, you can imagine how difficult this might be for a small publication, because if a small publication has to defend itself in a territory which is quite far from where it functions out of, it will effectively go out of business. Just the cost of defending the suit is going to throw it out of business, and that would in turn lead to it possibly withdrawing its publication. And and ultimately, this is another kind of chilling effect that the law tends to have.
Pamela, you've been on the receiving end of this stuff at The Wire. Tell us about it.
Yes, I mean, the process is the punishment. And at the moment, we are going through various cases. And and we are being courageous about it. And we are taking the consequences of it, the disturbance and disruptions because we believe that freedom of expression, which is constitutionally guaranteed, is worth defending.
Let the record show that Congress were pretty much as appalling as Modi when it came to controlling state narrative, particularly about the murderers of Sikhs or Muslims or Dalits. The party also shut down reports they didn't like. So, you know, it's not new, is it, Pamela?
It's not new, but I think what has happened is that there is a convergence of opinion, and that creation of that convergence is what's interesting. And it's also a lot to do with the political corporate powers behind news gathering in India today.
It doesn't seem to be affecting either of you two. You're both being very sort of powerful in your arguments, Sarith and Pamela.
Well, I mean, I think we have little option but to try and fight the fight forces of evil, I think, wherever one sees it. I mean, I don't think anyone can claim that they're free of fear or free of intimidation in any way. But I think the facts are there to be seen in terms of the number of journalists who have suffered on account of a lack of press freedom. Pamela highlighted many of these instances. And there's no question that there is a real threat to freedom of speech in India, and that's and we possibly require a different kind of movement to quell this threat, a different kind of political social movement, really.
I want to go on to the curtailing of free speech in a broader context shortly, as in academia, the history wars and so on. But before I do, Pamela, Reporters Without Borders have linked the harassment and murder of journalists to an alleged army of trolls called, I think, Yodas, supported by Modi's BJP.
I'm not really familiar with that. But yes, we do know that there are armies of trolls working for the ruling party in various ways. And part of their I think responsibility is to intimidate. And like I said, because they don't have a name and they exist in real time, as it were, they can respond in real time, they are protected in many ways from, for instance, defamation suits.
In the US, the atrocities, the attacks on media by Trump, in fact, almost everything that Trump does has a blowback effect and sometimes helps fund or recruit, from the other side of the political argument. Is that happening in India, Sarith? Is there a blowback which is energizing public debate?
I mean, I don't think it's particularly evident right now. I mean, Pamela can correct me if I'm wrong, but one hopes that we get to see a similar kind of blowback. And I should also clarify here with respect to the earlier question that you posed. I mean, it's easy enough for me possibly to write a piece of opinion. I think the real danger is faced by reporters who are out there reporting on sort of really difficult situations, who are reporting on political news, who are reporting on different sort of on matters of corruption in businesses and so forth. And I think they're the ones who really face this threat and intimidation. And it's there for everyone to see, really.
Actually, Suthrit put it so well, you know, that exactly is the issue. If you're talking of responses, I think a very promising one is the new fact checker who is trying to actually, there's a new breed of people who are actually trying to get back and correct the picture. But their impact is very limited at the moment.
And are they working through social media or mainstream media?
No, mostly through social media. And therefore, get read by people who are convinced by what they are saying rather than the other side, as it were. So they are in a information bubble, unfortunately, yeah.
But the fact that they
exist is important.
See, Ruth, there's a lot of attempts to rewrite history. Well, that happens in every country, and we've had our history wars for decades. But in yours, of course, there's a passionate effort to rewrite history from a Hindu slant, with Hindus as the victors, Muslims as the villains.
Well, I mean, this is sort of part of the larger political narrative, really, in India, and where there have been some who have asked for a Hindu state, and I don't think that's constitutionally compatible. And there are, because India is a secular country, India, the Indian constitution guarantees secularism. The preamble to the Indian constitution specifies explicitly that India is a secular state. And these really are efforts to kind of strike a blow at that secular fabric. And it, I think, speaks to the larger problem, which possibly, you know, which also speaks to the kind of lack of press freedom that we might enjoy, or any of the other civil liberties that are under threat. And to fight that, as I said, ultimately you'd require a different kind of socio-political movement. And I think even with the Congress, which is sort of one of the core, which is essentially the largest opposition party, you could see with the kind of campaign that they ran in Gujarat, for example, which is one of the regional states in the west of India, you could see that even their narrative wasn't essentially attuned to fighting against this sort of core narrative of India being a Hindu state. So I think we ultimately require a larger movement which will really fight against these forces.
It's quite some time since Arundhati Roy was last on the program, but I understand that she's been taken to court. What's that about, Pamela?
Arundhati Roy did face a sedition case and she went to jail on that. But at the moment, I don't think she's facing any case as such. But yes, she is targeted because she has spoken out a lot on what is happening, and she has not pulled her punches. So she is actually quite an inspiring figure for those who want to speak out and who believe that the chilling effect should be defeated.
Surith, I mentioned in the outlet at the outset that you're also a lawyer at the Madras High Court. Are you getting support from the judiciary in its upper echelons? Are there judges, for example, who are speaking out or expressing concern?
Historically in India, the judiciary has sort of stood as this bastion of civil liberties. So that's the standard narrative at any rate. And there have been numerous instances when the courts have spoken out on issues of civil liberties, where they've upheld the rights of journalists, where they've upheld the rights of the press, where they've upheld the rights of individuals to speak freely, to express themselves freely. But I mean, the larger problem with the judiciary in terms of its institutional integrity, and I think that's at stake here, because we've seen a number of different kinds of laws and legislation which have been upheld by the courts despite their having a serious impact on civil liberties. So if you take an ultimate analysis, you'll find that the courts haven't really stood up to the government or stood up to the state in upholding civil liberties. There have been stray incidents and there have been some glorious cases where the courts have really kind of sort of read the constitution in a meaningful way, in a manner that would place the individual at the heart of India's political movement. But I think in most cases, you'll find the court towing the government's line.
We've watched with fascinated horror the stacking of the Supreme Court in the US in recent years. Is it possible for Modi's government to stack the high courts of India, Surya?
Well, the process of appointing judges to India is particularly complicated. And one can write a whole thesis on this. And because the problem is, the constitution says that the executive appoints judges, but there have been a number of judgments, and through these judgments, the court has essentially appropriated this power unto itself. And today, judges are appointed by what is known as a collegium, which essentially comprises the Chief Justice of India and his senior most colleagues. But ultimately, of course, this does involve some give and take with the government. And this is a process that is highly opaque. There's no transparency involved at all. So we really don't know how judges are appointed to the country. But in terms of stacking judges in a manner similar to the US, I mean, it's hard to tell whether that can really happen, because there has been a pushback against these kind of political judicial appointments in the past. And possibly there will be a similar kind of pushback that will come up very soon.
Pamela, we talked briefly about social media. I can see that it poses a threat. It poses threats everywhere, but it also gives people a voice. It does democratize information, or it has that capacity. Tell me that that's happening in India big time, please, Pamela.
Yes, it is. And I think people are trying to use the spaces available to them. But remember that even social media is controlled. It's not as if it's, the internet today we know is being controlled by the big digital giants. And similarly, I mean, it is difficult for people to actually, I think self-censorship also figures here. It'll be difficult for, professional journalists to, use the social media without getting their managements, getting uptight over it. For instance, recently we saw the firing of a young woman who tweeted about the policy. She made a general tweet about the media and generally how they should conduct themselves, and we saw that she was summarily, sort of dismissed. So, I mean, it is difficult to even use the social media. I'm saying that the structures don't allow easy, freedom of expression, even in social media.
Sirith, do you augment your activities with social media? Do you use it?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I do post articles that I write or general pieces of opinion on social media, but I don't face the same kind of pushback because I'm sort of an independent professional. I'm not accountable to a boss or to anyone of that kind. But I think the case of the journalist getting fired recently is quite shocking because, ultimately, to express a simple piece of opinion and to lose your job because of that, I think that kind of really exemplifies the state of India's press freedom today.
We talked about various forms of censorship. Another subtle one, of course, is access. And I suppose if the government doesn't like you, it can pretty much slam the door in your face, Sirith.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's particularly easy because in India, I think the media is in many ways diverse. There are a number of different outlets. And I think with the internet, there has been a greater access that's provided to a number of people to express their opinions. But it is a particular source of worry when journalists can lose their jobs so easily, and which would mean that a number of these media outlets essentially fear that the government might come against them in some way or the other if they choose to allow these journalists to kind of act independently.
And we've got to wind it up, and I thank you both enormously for your contribution. Pamela Philippos, public editor at The Wire in New Delhi, and Sirith Pathasarathy, journalist and attorney at the Madras High Court.